Hello and welcome to the Track and Poop Podcast. You're joining us on another lovely day today. My name is Jamie Ma.
I'm gorgeous.
A gorgeous.
It wasn't supposed to be.
Gorgeous Wednesday day today.
My phone told me it was rain. And then I went to get my hair cut. The clouds parted. And then all of a sudden we had this beautiful, gorgeous sunny day.
It's a beautiful day
today. It wasn't supposed to happen like that.
No, it wasn't supposed to happen that way. But I'm your host as always, Jamie Ma. And the person you're listening to there is my co-host, Mickey McLeod. Mickey,
yes,
how are you?
I'm well.
Yeah, your hair does look pretty
good.
Thank
you. Today. I got a haircut. So. Yeah, it's a little too short. 2 weeks, it'll be perfect.
Okay. we are here and we're very excited to be talking to a gentleman who's putting on a wonderful wine festival here in Vancouver. It's called Top Drop and it's going to be landing in the city here starting next week on May 23rd.
24th.
May 23rd and 24th. That voice you
Thursday,
hear there.
Thursday, Friday.
It is Thursday, Friday. That voice you hear there is none other than Curtis Colt. If you've never heard of Curtis Colt, he's a very renowned figure in the Vancouver wine and BC community. He writes for the Georgia Strait. You write a weekly column, am I correct?
A weekly column, yeah.
Weekly column. You've written for plenty of other publications, I'm assuming.
Yeah, occasional things for Vancouver Magazine and then a few international pursuits here and there.
Did you get into Decanter?
I did. Yes, I did a wine-fueled tour of Vancouver, the places that I like to go.
I saw that. I remember reading that a couple months ago, so it was very...
Yeah, that's kind of a bucket list.
That's a pretty
being
big
able
one.
To contribute to Decanter. That was, pretty rad.
Did they seek you out or did you find them?
I was at an event in Italy called Collisioni, and it's kind of a food, music, and wine event, and Stephen Spurrier... the legendary
Stephen Spurrier,
yes, of Decanter magazine, the Judgment of Paris and so on, and he was there and I had met him once before and he's kind of, you know, editor at large of the magazine, and I had seen that they do every issue. There's a certain city guy that they get a local who's in the industry somehow to pass along their favorite places to go to hang out, and so I was reading one, and actually it was on Toronto, and so I looked on the site. I'm like, have they ever done Vancouver? No. So I reached out to him and I was like, hey, I know this isn't your call who does these, but I'll bet you know the person who, you know, who does. And so I reached out to them and I said, hey, you want me to do a thing? And they said, yeah,
perfect.
Yeah, wow. And the best part was also they said they specifically wanted it to be my Vancouver. They didn't want me to – they didn't want something that, you know, is also going to be all the Vancouver Magazine Restaurant Award winners or, you know, the place that are getting the most Yelp or the
it's
the
like what you love.
Yes, exactly, where I go and hang out and stuff like that. And so as a lot of wine places were obviously mentioned, but then I talked about Revolver for coffee, the Alibi Room for craft beer and that sort of thing. So it was just nice to give shout outs to a lot of local places that I love and share them. And it was great.
I think
Decanter?
Yeah, Decanter Magazine is probably, it's based in the UK. It's probably one of the biggest
In the
wine.
UK, wow.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest wine magazines in the world. I mean, you have Decanter in the UK, you have Wine Spectator here in North America.
Okay.
And those are probably the two foremost ones. And then you also have, others that stick out. Jancis Robinson has her website, which is a really prominent one as well.
Yeah.
And I love Decanter. I think I like Decanter more than Wine Spectator. Mm-hmm. I like the kind of a lot of the stuff they put on there a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I mean, but they're both really good in their own way of presenting.
So this was recently?
This was almost a year ago. Yeah, like last year. Because I think of when I actually did it versus when it came out in print.
Yeah.
A bit of a lag there. Yeah. It was great.
No, and I think you just brought up something really interesting is I think Alibi Room is one of those few places in the Vancouver that's kind of like been around for so long that people kind of take it for granted.
Yeah.
And I just think, I love the fact that you kind of throw a little shade their way and give them a little love because I think they get forgotten.
Well, they were the original beer bar in Vancouver, essentially.
Yes.
They started everything.
And they were their first owner was Jason Priestley.
Uh-huh. Ties with Brass Neck, of course.
Yes. One of the things that I liked about it as well, actually probably the most heartening thing, as well as, you know, having my byline in there, was the following issue. A gentleman wrote a letter to the editor saying that usually these places on cities around the world aren't that relevant to him. He doesn't travel that much, but he was in Vancouver for a work thing, had read it, and had followed my advice, and he went to Wildebeest.
Oh, perfect.
In Gastown, and he said he absolutely loved it, the wine program, the cocktails, you know, Chef Ian McHale's food, and it was fantastic. And he said, you know, it's a place that he probably wouldn't have stumbled on his own, and he would have probably got stuck in some sort of tourist trap. So, you know, thanks to Curtis Colt for mentioning, and yeah. That's like, first of all, totally. Someone read it.
Yeah,
that's definitely right. One person read the thing, and then they followed it, and then I got to tell Wildebeest that they owe me one.
Yeah. It's like, do.
Come on, guys. You
if anyone from Wildebeest is listening.
Well, it's interesting because I just finished doing an interview with those guys today, and it just landed on Scout today with James and Josh.
Yes. So, yeah. So check that out, listener.
Yeah. So they definitely do owe you one. but it's kind of funny when you point that right there. It's like people, you're like, oh, someone actually read it. It's like one of those things. Sometimes like when we do this podcast, you're like, is there anyone out there listening?
Is anybody listening? Don't worry. People are listening.
Yes. But we didn't come here to talk about that. We came here to talk about Curtis's upcoming wine festival, Top Drop.
Yes, absolutely.
I've attended Top Drop every year that you've done it. I think it's fantastic. I love it so much more than the Vancouver International
what
Wine Festival.
What is Top Drop?
So Mickey.
I just want to say first, two episodes ago, if you listen to this podcast, we had one of my favorite spots in Vancouver. It's a tea bar. I'm a huge tea nerd. I'm a huge tea snob, actually, as well, which might relate into what we're talking about, but not tea. And Jamie doesn't drink caffeine, drink pop, doesn't drink coffee, doesn't drink tea. And luckily for me, he let me bring on Pedro Villalone, who is...
How do you say that again?
Villalone?
Yeah. I always butcher it. Who is the owner and co-founder of O5 Rare Tea Bar on West 4th, which is my favorite spot to hang out. I'm usually there twice a week. And this is going to be the exact flipped script of that episode, because even though I am a bartender, my wine knowledge, I consider it to be very minute compared to people like you guys sitting across from me. Although I do know my, you know, like my snappy tasting notes and all that kind of stuff, just because I have to be, because I have to sell wine to my guests.
But, sure.
So this is going to be the opposite of the 05 episode for me. So I'm very excited. Got my pen and paper out. Not really, metaphorically speaking.
So you just asked one question right there. You can, what is Top Drop?
What is Top Drop? That's right. For me and also for people listening.
Top Drop is a terroir-driven wine festival. It's particularly aimed at trade in here in Vancouver. We also do have a Calgary edition. It's primarily focused on trade, and we like to showcase wineries that are a little bit more hands-on, you know, sustainable farming, that sort of thing, and they're... just a little bit more caring through the process. We're not really into highlighting wineries that are, you know, big industrial making factory wines and that sort of thing. there are so many beyond them that wouldn't be a fit. It's you know what, it's been really good, and we ensure also that the principals from wineries from around the world who are coming, that they are here. So you have winemakers, proprietors, vineyard managers. So you're actually, you know, talking to the person behind the wine. And we like, you know, wines that reflect, the place where they're from. They reflect their vintage. And, you know, winemaking decisions are made by a winemaker and not by, you know, a board of directors or the marketing team. Because, the audience wants X, Y, or Z. So, you know, make your pink wine darker or lighter or, you know, none of that. This is
the opposite of
authentic, real wine.
The opposite of apothec, basically.
Yes.
Why do people drink that? Oh my God, that god awful wine. Who makes that anyways?
It's based, I believe
it's Gallo, isn't it?
Gallo,
is it Gallo product?
Gallo does
oh
that.
My God. Yeah.
It's 70, I think.
Well, horrible.
It's sweet. It's a blend. There's so much manipulation going on there. I think they charge it at like the sweet spot price. It's not too cheap. It's not too expensive.
Yeah.
I think
it's
$17.99.
Yeah. And people equate, you know, like it's rich and gloopy and bombastic and sweet and heavy, but people equate that with value. You know, the more alcohol there is, the more richness and that sort of.
So
they
do we
think
blame
that
California for that over the last 20 years?
No, you know, I don't think you can.
The big California cabs that are really juicy and like there's no tannin and everything is like really soft and sweet.
I don't think you can go. I mean, I don't think you can blame it entirely on California. I mean, California does definitely lends itself to having, because of their sunshine and a lot of the way the grapes ripe there. And because, I mean, they definitely are known for Cabernet Sauvignon. But, I mean, people do gravitate towards that kind of rich. I think Curtis just hit it right there. People like something that looks dark.
Yeah, yeah.
They think that it creates quality and they think that, yeah. You know. But I think people also think about all this times when they talk about, like, I want a wine that's dry. However, generally, even those wines.
What is dry to you?
Well, even though those wines aren't really dry in a lot of ways. Like, yeah. they are, but they aren't in some ways.
Or is your Riesling sweet?
Like, yeah, so, but.
Yeah, wow.
It is what it is. But I love the philosophy that you guys do with this festival. I mean, I remember when you guys first came up with it. I loved how it was very terroir driven, but also when you're talking about meeting with producers that are looking to put out great wines, like Synchromesh and Comina and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. So it's not BC specific.
It's not. It's international. We do have a good handful of BC wineries every year, and basically each year. We put out kind of an opportunity to apply to local import agencies and BC wineries, and we have a selection committee of it's a couple dozen of BC and Alberta's best sommeliers and retailers, and they go through all the applications, and it's about, you know, who fit our criteria of, you know, sustainably farming, authentic wines. Who don't you see that often in our market? Because there are a lot of, you know, wineries that are doing great things, but, you know, they'll do Vancouver International Wine Fest. They'll do the BC Wine Institute's, you know, Bloom and or Color, or they just visit the market a lot. And so a lot of times for us, even though, hey, it might, you know, tick the boxes with the criteria as far as being authentic wines that reflect their vintage, blah, blah, blah. People are like, well, I kind of know them. Like they're around a lot. Who don't we see?
Exactly.
And so we have, I'd say this last year, we could accommodate about 40 wineries. We had a little over 100 applications, and it's great. We're getting more and more critical mass over the years, but now it's tough because due to space, we're saying no to some, you know, awesome people.
Are you guys going to, so currently right now, you guys have been the last couple of years at the Roundhouse.
At the Roundhouse in Yaletown, correct.
Is that a space that you think you're going to have to outgrow eventually?
We never want to leave the Roundhouse. It's just such a good
space. I love the Roundhouse space because it's perfect for what you do.
Yeah. And you know, it's a great location because it's accessible by transit and all of that. It's pretty central. But another thing about the Roundhouse, you know, there everything has a reason for being here in the wine scene here. And, you know, if you look at, say, the Vancouver International Wine Festival, it's been phenomenal in developing a consumer savviness about wine in general. You know, it's one of the biggest wine festivals in the world. It's gotten people kind of in the rhythm of knowing wine events and learning and that
asking
sort of
questions,
thing.
Yeah.
But they're very, very big. I think it's almost 200 wineries a year. And so we don't want to become that because they already are that and they're very good at doing it. What we are doing, you know, we're small in scale, and what we like with ours is, you know what it's like when you go to the wine festival, like it's great, but you can't
talk to
anyone. You have a plan, you can't accomplish anything because there's just so much going on. You're seeing people and everything. And so with ours being the size it is, if you're on it, and I think even with ours, realistically, it's kind of difficult, but you can do the whole room if you wanted to, if you really pushed, you could actually visit each table. Another thing we do is we don't set up the room regionally by country or part of the world. We do it alphabetically by winery because we don't want people coming in and saying, oh, I only like California wine. I'm going to go there, or I'm going to steer clear of Australia, because, you know, we guarantee you all the wineries in the room are really good, and we want people to do it. And then you happen upon a place or region you're unfamiliar with. It's just, you know, the scope of the Roundhouse, it's good. It's just, it's a great room, nice light during the day. We had a fire alarm a couple of years ago at the trade edition. And so you had 200 people in there, and all these suppliers from all over the world, Italy and France and Portugal and Spain and everything. And all of a sudden, fire alarm goes off, and your first instinct is always like, well, false alarm.
Yeah, false alarm.
Which it was. Just as a spoiler alert, it was. But the lady who was managing the Roundhouse at the time was, I happened to be walking past her when I went, and I said, oh, so what happens now? And she said, we evacuate. Like, yeah, we have 100 people manning tables, winemakers and everything. There's 200 trade in the room. And, oh, okay. But the good thing is there's that big wall of windows and doors. open it all out. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And so the entire room evacuated. And of course, everyone, you can't bring your drinks outside. And so everyone had to, there was tables and we had to collect glasses on their way out. And everyone's standing out there in the sun and everything. Oh, this is crazy. What's going to happen? And of course, we're kind of flipping out because how bad will this get?
Yeah.
And then within, I think, 10 minutes, maybe, they said, okay, it was a false alarm. Everyone can go back in. And then we realized everyone's put down. We don't know, like, whose glasses is who.
Yeah.
And we accidentally that you're over-ordered glassware. And so we were able to, we just had racks. And as people walked in, we just handed out fresh glasses and everything. And it was like 15 minutes later from start to finish, and it was like nothing ever happened. Then a few people who were arriving late are like, oh, hey, this is looking good. It's like you have no idea what just happened. But it was fun, wasn't it?
It was great. I remember me and Ron Oliver standing there. We were out in the sun and we were chatting, and I remember going up to Jeff.
Wine break in the sun.
I remember going to your co-founder, Jeff Curry, and I was just like, so how are you guys doing? He's like, I don't want to talk about this right now.
We act on the surface.
But now it's a great story, and we're just, if we were on the fifth floor of a hotel, that would have been so much more of a nightmare to go and nose it. But
it was great. It was a beautiful day, and you were in that little courtyard, and one of my favorite things about going to that, because having gone to many years of the Vancouver International Wine Festival, is this festival, you get to go, and like you said, it's small. You get to talk to, you actually get to have like hands-on conversations with all, like pretty much anyone. There's no major lineups. You're not trying to like breakneck and get around people. The people that are pouring you the wines are actually listening to you, and they actually want to have a conversation with you. They're actually interested in like where you work or what you do. And it makes for a way more enjoyable experience, but also you actually get to learn some stuff.
Yeah.
You get to learn about these wineries. And I'm not saying that just because I'm very excited to have you on today. I'm just saying that as someone who, I do love like what you say about the Vancouver International Wine Festival. I love how it exposes the general public to certain wines and kind of gets them asking questions and gets them learning about things.
Is that the one that we went to?
We went to the California the California Expo.
Okay. Yeah.
But this one is great because the Vancouver National Wine Festival, what it does is it does expose BC wine, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
I think it's been really beneficial for the market to kind of showcase that BC does have a market and that we are emerging, because we've only been around basically since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And how the market is changing. And I would like to touch on that eventually through this interview with you, because the BC, there's been some wonderful great BC wineries that have kind of popped up on the radar over the last like 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something like this is really, really cool.
Well, it's so funny because for people listening, as I mentioned previously, my wine knowledge is very minuscule compared to these two people beside me. But I did attend with Ron Oliver, a friend of the show, shout out to Ron, and Jamie, the California Wine Festival, and speak exactly to what you're talking about. I found my experience to be like a little bit overwhelming. And then when I decided I was going to branch off and go on my own and go to where I wanted to go, the reps were just kind of like, it's like, okay, here's our flagships. And like, almost even no eye contact. Like, here's our Pinot Noir, here's a bit, and like kind of like looking to see if anyone else of importance is around.
Yeah.
And that was my experience there, just being like, okay, well, obviously you don't really give a shit that I'm here and don't want to talk to me about your wine. So I was just like sampling stuff. Very unattended is the word I would use.
But
that was my experience as a first timer.
For sure. You know, it's funny because it is a two-way street. And Jamie had mentioned Jeff Curry, who's my business partner, co-founder of it. And so my background, to go back, I used to run restaurants in Vancouver, be a sommelier, wine director guy. And, the idea of top drop, like it's not, I'm not going to say, we invented this idea of a small terroir driven, wine festival. Just people in the industry for a long time is, hey, we need something kind of this model in this city. Who's going to do it? Who has time? And then, when I left the restaurant world, I was starting to do some freelance writing, consulting with restaurants. And I'm like, okay, I have the time. And I guess more importantly, the energy to put into this. I can't do it alone. And my good friend, Jeff Curry, he's an importer. He's an agent. And
Wine Syndicate, by the way.
Yeah, the Wine Syndicate. They have a phenomenal portfolio. And, we knew we were on the same page with what we like about shows, wine shows, and what we don't like about wine shows. And, I know, as an example, for the trade who attend Top Drop, we're pretty strict. You have to be either in management or a buyer or a senior staff. This isn't a place for, the busters from Milestones to come in and get pissed, right? Nothing against busters from Milestones. But it's just not that kind of room. It's at Elva. And so what frustrates me as a buyer or a media, if I'm at an event, is if there's just people at a trade event that aren't you know, there for the right reasons. And they're just kind of, you know, taking up a producer's time or whatever, hanging out. And I'm kind of behind them and, hey, I need, like, I'm here to work. And at the same time, for someone like my business partner who's behind the table pouring, you know, their time is going to be wasted by someone who's just there for the fun and the drinks. Meanwhile, they see there's a key buyer or key media behind them who's not going to stand around that long before moving along.
Totally.
And so
it's a two-way street. Like
yeah, you said, yeah. So we have fostered this. And I think that with the focus of our event and how we've branded ourselves, we've ended up with a very savvy consumer audience as well in the evening. And these are people who, you know, they shop at Whole Foods, they shop at farmers markets, they care about where their food comes from, how it's grown, and they understand that wine isn't something that just magically appears on a shelf, that, you know, it is farmed, it is food. And because of that, you know, and that's the thing that frustrates a lot of importers or winemakers, because so many times at consumer events, they just stick out the glass and, you know, you'll go to tell them something about the region and they'll just say, oh, what's your most expensive? Or, you know, they don't want to hear it. And that's a thing. So it does really go both ways. And so we feel that we are in the process of kind of fostering a good culture where it's back and forth. And we find that our consumers will say, you know what, Italy, I usually stick to Chianti. I don't really know Barolo. What makes it different? And then, you know, the person's like, oh, happy to talk and do that. And so, yeah, it's a good energy in the room.
So what you're saying is probably half my fault too, is what you're saying.
Totally. It's
totally.
Fucking Mickey, huh?
Oh, man. Yeah. Hey, give me most expensive wine.
Being a retard, huh?
Look at you. Well, you know, I'm trying to learn.
This guy lied to me the other day, sitting on his balcony. He's just like, I'm drinking some Chablis. I'm like, you're drinking Chablis? I'm like, nice. And he's like, nah, it's just cheap Pinot Grigio. And
I
was like,
I feel slightly embarrassed about that.
But who, so you touched on it a little bit there. Who? So was it a cumulative effort of you two coming together being like, we want to do this? Or was there like...
Yeah.
Yeah? Was it just like one day you guys just having drinks and just like, I think this is something that we could probably do?
Of course it happened over drinks. The thing is, you know, like I said, it's not like it was our idea. Just everyone, as you know, it comes up and it comes up during a lot of other, you know, wine events. Oh, you know, I wish we had like kind of like smaller, you know, more of a hyper-focused wine event that reflect all these tiny producers that may or may not be a fit for the bigger shows. You know, they're a little bit more expensive to participate in and so on. And the volume you have to do just because so many people come to them. And so there's just often just these discussions around the trade. Oh, you know, someone should. Eventually, it was just chatting with Jeff over at Drake's. Okay, well, what could it look like? How would we do it? And I think my initial pitch to him, what about we get just a bunch of your producers for the first year, just to show that we can, you know, start to build something. How about a bunch of the producers that you import, you do it, and so almost like a portfolio tasting. And then we can, once people see it, they'll come in more. And when he said, well, you know, let's get some like-minded people. So we talked to a few other importers that may have been into it. And the thing is, you know, they have to convince winemakers to come over here for a show that doesn't exist yet and promise that, well, we promise it'll be good and you got to trust these guys. And so it just evolved that way. And then a few other importers were just kind of picking up what we were laying down. And the first year we did it at Heritage Hall on Main Street.
Yeah.
Which is great because it's a very affordable venue.
Yeah.
And for our first year, and it was a good size and everything. And then it just built from there. And we've, you know, brought others onto our team because it's a bit more to manage. Now, I think that first year we had 20 wineries. So we're at, you know, 40 now. We've added a whole slate of like seminars and evening programming. And so there's just... there's a lot more aspects to it than there was that first year.
That was
like an educational...
I was going to touch on that pretty soon here, but like that's one of the things that I think. Well, I was just more curious about because I kept trying to wrap my head around this. I'm like, how do you put on a wine festival? Like, what do you?
Yeah,
the logistics of it. How do you convince all these people, especially you're flying people all like they're flying across the world to come to this? And
I was like,
do you have to put them up, or do they have to figure that out? I was just my head's just like I'm like, and then they're here usually for a week, and then it's like you got all these things, and I'm like, I'm like, I can't even fathom how much work this is. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, exciting.
Got to be real organized.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you've brought on some people in the past now that are a part of it now. Like DJ probably works with you guys.
DJ helped start our seminar program and getting moderators up to speed. Since then, the reins of that is now Jason Yamasaki. Who is the wine director for the Joey Restaurant Group. For all the Canadian and American outlets, and he was BC Sommelier of the Year
2015. Yeah.
Oh, so, wow, you have that on the back here.
Well, yeah. Hold on. I competed in 20. Well, maybe I competed in 2015. I think he might have been 2014. Okay. I competed the year after him.
Right. Yeah, that sounds about right. And so he's great.
Super
smart
nice guy.
And so he oversees the seminar. Program and our seminars are also run. They're moderated by local wine directors and sommeliers, a lot of younger ones. That's another thing at other shows. A lot of times, as great as it is, it when it comes down to it, our industry, we're still a pretty small town. And so often it's the same people leading or moderating seminars. Sure. And, you know, it could be Reese Pender, Master of Wine, or DJ, or, you know, often it's me. So, you know, we're just like, hey, we love doing this, but let's bring some others up and into the fold.
I saw Christy's doing one of them.
Yeah, Christy from Laboratoire is.
She's really
doing
emerging.
One.
I think she's going to be an emerging psalm in the city. Mm. So she's the lead psalm at Laboratoire now.
Yeah,
yeah, she's cool.
So that's really great. So Jason Yamasaki oversees that entire seminar programming and working out everything, coordinating venues and rentals and all of that stuff, audiovisual needs and. There's a lot that go into them.
So I saw that you guys are also doing now, because you guys have been doing the trade ones for a while. But
yeah.
You guys are doing, because I've attended them.
And yes.
I've already gotten tickets to the Riesling one, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, cool.
About.
Awesome.
But this year you're doing something a little bit different now. You guys are doing I've noticed you guys are doing some more public ones.
Yeah. So on the Thursday evening, Thursday, May 23rd, we're really excited because in the past, we had so much on our plate that we kind of left it to a lot of wineries and local agents to say, hey, if you want to do a dinner, great, organize it yourself, and you know, we'll co-brand it, and if you can throw a few bucks per seat to the charity, our partner charity. So we are a third-party fundraiser for the BC Hospitality Foundation, which is our industry's charity, and it provides financial support to those in the industry who are facing a major medical crisis. So something happens to someone in the industry, it could be anything from they need a wheelchair ramp installed, they don't have the money, but a lot of times someone, you know, they're going through cancer treatment, but if they're in their mid or late 20s, odds are they don't have a lot of money saved up. And you know, when you're doing that, last thing you should have to worry about is being able to pay your rent or put food in the fridge. And so the BC Hospitality Foundation kind of offers that safety net. That's who we use as a partner charity. And so we always make sure everything we do.
Was that a conscious decision in the beginning to always have that?
100%.
100%?
Yeah.
I like that.
So
you guys aren't taking really much as in profits when it comes to doing these
things.
Oh,
profit, no.
No.
Making
money, who does that?
Yeah, we're more about the slow build and keeping it on a track. You know, I'm sure that there would be the opportunity to get some, you know, massive corporate sponsors, you know, here and there that may or may not be a fit, but if they are a fit, we want them to be a fit. You know, we don't.
How's
want
that coming your way so far? Have you been approached?
There are certain companies who we do work with, which is great. But Puttyfoot for, you know, glassware, A&B Rentals, Container World, you know, they've all been, you know, fantastic.
No apothic
or anything like that, you know, or a big pesticide company, yeah. Or that it's not going to be that. So yeah, so you know, often dinners we had mixed success over the years. Sometimes a winery put them together and okay, well, who's promoting it and all of that, and you know, this winemaker's dinners can also be quite price prohibitive, you know, $125-$150. This is clearly a very expensive city to live in. Disposable income is tough. And so this year we decided to just kind of flip it on its head. And so we're doing a bunch of events that are more kind of stand up, walk around grazing events. And we approached a bunch of places that are restaurants that, you know, we're friends with. And everything conveniently within a block of your home, Jamie.
I know, it's amazing. So Curtis, like I've known Curtis in the industry for, I've known of you, and we've talked a lot over the last couple of years here. But I didn't realize you lived this close to me. So you live just right around the corner. We both live right basically next to Mammy Taylor's. So I've seen you there numerous times.
Chinatown.
But you're right. I mean, a lot of these places we're talking about, Bodega on Main, Wildebeest Boulevard. We're going to Campagnolo. We're going to the American. We're going to Mammy Taylor's.
So you said like a standalone, like casual grazing situation instead. I really like that actually, instead of like a full like coursed sit down.
For sure. As an example, you know, we're doing this one called The Nature of Things at the American, and it's basically a natural wine event. The wineries that we're working with this year that you know, may or may not officially refer to themselves as natural wine, but they are, you know, organically grown, very minimal manipulation in the winery, low sulfur use and so on, however you want to, you know, define natural wine. But so we have there 7 different wineries from all around the world. So we have some locals like Lockenworth and Little Farm, but then Viña do Martino from Chile, who are doing some cool things, Maule from the Veneto in Italy. And so basically we're going to have winemakers with wine stations. So kind of like a mini wine tasting, walking around, but you get a bit of a heartier pour and music's going to be up a bit. And then we have Chef Rob Belcham's Monarch Burger, who are going to be doing the food programs of burgers and fries and everything. Let's just, you know, Megan, kick back and
Mickey,
have a good
time. They have a vegan option for you.
They better. We're in Vancouver, for fuck's sakes.
They will. Absolutely.
That's cool. Wine and burger and fries. I like that casual approach to it, totally. Which I think a lot of people maybe have misconceptions on kind of wine and how stuffy it can be sometimes. So
for sure,
like that's not really the case.
So I'm looking here right now. I love Little Farm. I love their wines. Are you trying to tell? I didn't know this. Are you trying to tell me that Rise Pender owns that winery?
Yes.
Oh my god, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Reese is Alishan, who's the winemaker. So Reese is more the wine grower. Just tiny little place in the Similkameen doing some great crunchy fresh.
Yeah, their wines are so good.
Yeah,
like their rosé.
Yeah,
amazing. I love what they're doing here. I think these are fantastic. I think the idea of doing these is a great way to kind of like, and the cool thing is, like you said, I mean, if people got tickets to a lot of them, they could just bounce around.
Yeah, like they're $55, you know, it's not a big thing. And, you know, we talked to the boys at Campagnolo there, and hey, you know, we have a bunch of Italian producers, let's just have a pizza party. And so they're going to be passing around house-made pizza and, you know, a few other things and salads and stuff. And again, a walk around styled tasting. You know, this was actually spawned by last year, speaking of Wildebeest, as we were earlier, James and Josh approached us and said, hey, you know, we really like what you're doing. We're thinking of doing a sausage and charcuterie party with just rosé wine. So did you want to hook us up with a few of your producers who make great rosé? And we'll just have this big rosé and sausage bash. And it would like, and it sold out
strange.
Super fast. Strangely delicious. it was good. So they did it downstairs at Wildebeest. You know, the music was up. A DJ was playing, and it was great. So they just passed around like sausages, charcuterie, and there was a bunch of wineries around pouring pink wine, and they also had some other stuff, you know, underneath the table here and there. And it was kind of that model where like, okay, this is clearly what people want. Something. And so they're bringing that event back this year too.
Can I ask a really noob question here? Why rosé specifically? Is there something about the salt with the sausage in that I'm like missing? Like I would never personally, like I would think with that, like Pinot Noir or something like that. So why rosé specifically?
Super,
I guess it's made from a Pinot Noir.
Well, first
grape,
of all,
Pinot Noir is a thing now, buddy. You should know this.
Yeah.
I know Pinot Noir.
People love Pinot Noir.
I know.
Or not Pinot Noir, I mean rosé. Rosé is it. Rosé is it.
Rosé is like that and sparkling wine are still the two kind of biggest, still exploding categories all around the world. Rosé is just massive. Just people are into it. We've finally got to the point that people aren't afraid to have it outside of summer. Mm-hmm. It's some of the most food-friendly wines because it's quite dynamic. You know, you get the refreshingness of your white wine, a little bit maybe more depth and character of a red wine. It can be made from various varieties, sometimes a little bit off dry, so that if you have a sausage or any food that has some heat to it, a little bit of off dry will help kind of envelop that heat. Rosé wines Instagram well, that's always important.
And people just love saying pink.
That's
true. And this event is called Pink Links.
Yes.
Okay. It's like a little sausage.
Yeah,
Pink Links. It's pretty good. Really good.
Right?
I'm learning so much. This
that was
fantastic.
Justin Everett, who was the wine. He's on paternity leave right now, but he was for many years the wine director at Wildebeest, Pink Link.
He's a great guy. He's a really good
guy. That's his name he came up with. Mm. And I know he's very proud of that as well. He should be.
But I agree with you. I mean, rosé, I mean, the cool thing about rosé is it's really starting to become very fashionable. People love it. And I mean,
well, I've noticed so many now are like the acidity level is like really high.
Yeah. And another thing that's kind of a funny thing that's happening is because a lot of them are trying to mimic styles coming out of the Provence, south of France, that we're seeing less and less color in them to the point that the pendulum is it's swinging almost as far as it could swing. Someone like, come on, you can have some color.
Like Whispering Angels. Yeah, in there. Whispering Angels pretty light.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and the Vieux Fermé, their Viola is like almost see-through.
No,
like,
you mean Le Vieux Fermé?
Le Vieux Pan.
Le Vieux Pan. Pan, sorry. Mm-hmm.
The Viola is awesome. That's a really good. That's
but
a great.
Like, yeah. It's like almost like not even pink.
Yes. Yeah. That is a thing that it's rare now to see that kind of Tavel, the richer kind of deeper hue. But you know, like these things, just like the use of oak, just you know, that pendulum will start to swing back and we'll find a sweet spot in the middle. But the good thing is, you know, I'm just happy that more people are drinking rosé. For the longest time, everyone was always so afraid it was going to be sweet, which like you're saying, you know, more and more dry styles. And I think, you know, sometimes it's like, hey, you could have a little bit in there because that's what's going to make it even more friendly.
Yeah. You give me rosé and I'll show you from the Loire Valley. I'm a happy boy.
So. One thing, so I guess you're speaking about balance, right? So one of my favorite wines, which I've always really loved for that balance of acidity and sweetness, was the Tantalus Riesling.
Totally.
Tantalus Riesling is, I think it's,
I think how something can be super, super, I don't know, you say dry. Is dry the same as acidic? I don't know.
No.
They're very different.
No. You have your, because as your grapes ripen, it's kind of like any other fruit, right? It's going to start earlier in the season. It's going to be a lot of like high acid and low sugar. Like if you pick a peach too early, really acidic and tart, right?
Yeah.
Not much sugar. But if you leave that peach hanging very end of the season and you bite into it, it's like dripping sugary sweet, right? And you've lost a lot of that acid. You're almost like eating it over things. So that's kind of... that's where the scale is between the two. But you could have a wine that's super fruity that could still be bone dry. When you say sweet or dry, usually you're referring to the amount of residual sugar that's there. And so a lot of times, even though it's really fruity in the mouth, if you know you swallow it and then it's just like, oh, dry, there's no residual sweetness in your mouth. Tantalus, well, their old vines,
their old vines Riesling is phenomenal,
and the acidity is, you know, tears your face off in a good way.
Yeah, like,
good way, yeah, exactly. Totally. What a perfect way to put it. Well, like, your face off in a good way.
One of the things that makes Riesling so amazing, and it's my favorite white varietal, is because it has so much acidity and it pairs so well with food.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you can grow it in Germany, you can grow it in certain places of the world, but like the acid, you can get...
Yeah,
the acid is so high and so mouth-watering, but you can still get good flavor, and it's not too sweet because the acid balances out the sweetness. So you can have a wine that has a good amount of residual sweetness, but it still has a ton of acid, and that's, I mean, it's a very unique grape varietal.
Well, isn't it the one varietal that has the highest pH, like the highest acidity out of all the grapes, essentially? Or did I read that wrong somewhere in my preparation?
It's variable.
The reason why that stood out to me when I was, this is like years ago I was reading this, is because... Traditionally, like the German style has been like, that's why people always ask like, oh, is it a sweet Riesling?
Yeah.
Because it's like almost that misnomer of big oaky cabs from California. It's like, that's how it's kind of been forever. So people always think of Rieslings as being sweet, but they're not.
No, because Alsatian Rieslings aren't.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, the best way to tell if a wine is sweet is just look at the alcohol content. If it's high, it's dry. Yeah. If it's low, it's sweet.
Yeah.
Eyes dry. Isn't that a Radiohead album?
That is a Radiohead song. And also, one of the things about Riesling is that to go for super high end, some of the world's best ones, you know, they're still relatively affordable. But, you know, compared to if you're looking at, you know, some of the world's best Pinot Noirs, like out of Burgundy, no one can afford them. Same with like Cabernet Bordeaux blends. But Rieslings, even, you know, top tier, are still great. And what I like about them is that you can actually. They age really well, and so that's the only thing, because, you know, we don't really have space for a quote-unquote cellar at home. It's a couple cases in a closet, but Rieslings are the things that we generally hold on to because they're a little bit more affordable. And
I have a 2012 JJ Prum sitting in my cellar right now.
Why isn't it on the table?
I
know, well, we could open it right now.
The words ran out of my mouth.
I want to hold that one for a bit.
Yeah.
So, just a bit lazy.
Yeah.
2012, wow.
Yeah, it's good. There's one other thing. There's a couple of things I was going to ask you. So you briefly touched on the idea that you've worked in the industry, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who don't know who you are.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if you could maybe give us a little bit of your history. Are you from Vancouver?
I grew up in Winnipeg.
Winnipeg. Oh.
I moved here in 1992, the day after I graduated from high school, literally the next day.
Nice.
I left Winnipeg. I originally came out here to do the struggling actor thing.
Ah,
And then within a year, it was like, wait, this is more struggle and not so much acting. And so I just kind of grew tired of it pretty quick. And I was working in restaurants just to earn a living.
As you do.
Yeah, just, no passion for it or anything like that. I was 18, 19, didn't really care. I was like busing at the Fish House and stuff like that. And just slowly kind of serving in various places, getting the opportunity to manage here and there, and then worked at places like Lucy May Brown back in the day. Ugh. Worked at Chin Chin, which
Card
is
emoji.
Right.
That's before my time. That closed in 2008, I think.
I'm not sure exactly when.
Maybe even a year or two.
I got here in 2009.
Another victim condo development, unfortunately. But that was a great place.
Because that was on Richards, right?
Yeah.
Chin Chin, I was there, and I always had, it was a restaurant I always admired, and so I was really stoked once I finally got in there serving. And then I was managing a place on Main Street at Main and 8th for a few years that was called Aurora Bistro, and it was Chef Jeff Van Geest, who's at Miradoro now at Tin Horn Creek. And he had been a sous chef at Bishop's in Kitsilano for a few years and decided to do a restaurant that was, it was, you know, one of the first, you know, Bishop's was there beforehand at the time, Rain City Grill, but it was, everything was local, produce, seafood, meat, everything. And we did an all BC wine list, which
was that novelty at that time? Like no one,
we were the
that?
Only ones doing it. And for a lot of people, it wasn't received well.
Because there was something that Andrew was talking. We had Andrew Morrison on 4 or 5 episodes ago, and he was talking about Bishop's and how they were kind of the forefront of that style of like farm table.
For sure, the 100-mile diet thing and everything. But when we did that, because at the time, you know, our wines certainly weren't where they are now. But even the ones that were making a mark, people still kind of weren't ready. They were like, "Oh, BC can do whites, but not reds," and they'd be kind of standoffish. Some people would be experimental, like into it. Of course, there was a lot less producers back then to choose from as well. But, you know, there was enough out there. But we would have people that would, because we got, you know, en route top 10 new restaurants across Canada, blah, blah, blah. So we got a fair amount of acclaim. And so we would have people that would book a table on a Friday night, 7 or 7:30, and they'd come in there and, you know, they had this reservation for a couple of weeks and they'd say, "Okay, can I see the rest of your wine list?" "Oh, it's an all, you know," and they would, "Oh, okay, then no." And they would get up and they would leave.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
My God.
That would never happen now.
That would never happen now.
Yeah. So
that's like one of my favorite things about the McKenzie Room is it's all BC. It's like an all Canadian wine list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, and then I kind of love that. I mean, I love the idea that we're celebrating our, you know, our background, and we want to make sure that we, I mean, there's a lot of restaurants nowadays. It's kind of in fad to be very prominent BC, Canadian wine in general. But I mean, it's not a bad thing. I don't think. And we, like you said, maybe 15. When was this for you? This is probably what?
This was 2003.
Yeah, so it's about 15 years ago. So we've definitely come a long way since then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And back then, you're probably just thinking Blue Mountain and Brewing Isle.
Yeah,
those kind of Mission Hills and stuff like this. But which isn't, I mean, they make great wines, but just, you have a lot more options now.
Yeah.
So,
and then
so
I
just
went,
get up and walk out of the restaurant.
Yeah. It was just, oh, well, lost another one. And then I went to, and then I ran Salt Tasting Room for the first 3 years.
That's where I first heard of you.
Yes. I believe you applied there.
I did apply.
I wasn't hiring at the time. And the reason that it was, because when you applied, and I'm sure that this is something that was totally on your radar at the time, is because at the time, the food editor of Vancouver Magazine, who was really the biggest critic in the city at the time,
Neil McLennan?
No, his name was Jamie Ma.
Oh yeah, my
M-A-W. And so it was very funny to get a resume from someone named Jamie Ma. Like, wait a second.
I was working at Chill Winston. I was working down the street and I wanted to get a second job. And I remember applying. So
But and then after Salt, I think it was 20 Yeah, 2010, just after the Olympics, I had gotten the Samoa of the Year thing, and I was just kind of at a crossroads. Oh. Like, what do I want to do? I'm either going to now go and own my own restaurant or do some sort of mix of consulting and writing and events and stuff. And I decided I do not want to own my own restaurant in the city. I like to sleep at night.
And, you like to have a life.
Yes, exactly. And so I just started consulting with restaurants and doing...
Was that scary?
It wasn't scary only because...
Like not getting the paycheck every 2 weeks?
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, I was already getting a couple opportunities here and there to write a few things, contribute a few things here and there, and consulting more as like favors. But I thought, you know, I can always pick up serving shifts somewhere if it's not, you know, making a go. I just can't be managing, running restaurants like I am. And so, you know, that first year, it was great. I'd have a few things that were on the go. And it'd be great. And I'd finish up these contracts. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then, oh God, now I have nothing. And then have to start to look for other stuff. So I didn't have that kind of rhythm or consistency. And there was, in fact, a friend of mine, a colleague, was running Mainom in Kitsilano at the time. And I've always been great friends with Chef Angus Ann. And there was a time where I was in one of those lulls, and it was right as they were going into Dine Out in Vancouver. And I was like, hey, can you use a hand? Because I can use some money. And so I went in there and I served a few weeks of Dine Out, and that just kind of helped, you know, lift me up out of it. And so those cameos, you know, definitely helped. And so I think that's the benefit of having that floor background, is it was never that scary because...
You can always just jump in somewhere. Yeah. You know enough people in the industry that you could find work and
exactly.
Do things.
Yeah.
I'm always scared of that. Like just that plunge, because like I kind of want to plunge more full time into
getting away from a steady paycheck thing.
Like, well, I love hospitality and I want to work in it, but part of me wants to kind of sometimes take the plunge and straight in journalism and just do that full time. But then I'm like,
As you just outlined, that's the beauty of our industry.
No, it is.
You have that opportunity,
but it's just like
not detach too far away from it, and then be like, pop in and hey, and then you can always people always need bodies on the floor. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, honestly, I thought about 50% of what I'd do, I thought at least 50% would be writing, and then the other side, and then you know you just look at where money, and you know the money's not in writing these days. Like it's, you know, there are things out there, but absolutely. There's literally less media.
You can blame that on two things: Google and Facebook.
Fuck Facebook.
All the advertising money went to both of them.
Yeah, people's brains are turning into mush slowly.
I guess, or on a broader point, you know, the internet.
The internet.
Yeah. Getting stuff for free. And so I feel quite fortunate that. Now been 4 years that I've been 4.5 years that I've been at the Georgia Strait to have a weekly wine column. You
it's
know,
great.
Nowadays, the fact that we still have an alternative news and entertainment weekly newspaper here, you know, when you've had, you know, New York, the Village Voice shut down and all that. So the fact that you know, we're still going here.
And they still do it in print too.
Yeah. They still do it in print.
Do they give you a lot of freedom when it comes to writing?
100%.
They don't.
I've never been, whatever I want to write about. And so, you know, my column, I don't call myself a journalist because I go to school for journalism. I don't have a degree or anything like that. I'm not really a reporter. So I am a columnist. And, you know, I think that my vantage point that I have in the industry is as someone who is a buyer and a consultant on occasion, and I go to wine tastings and I'm you know, active. And so my point of view is that of someone who's kind of in it, and wines that I come across and stories and people that I come across doing what I do, compared to a more traditional wine journalist who is, you know, reporting on things and or just, you know, receiving wines to review, score, all of that. It's more just kind of a column about like kind of my life and wine. Oh, I discovered these things over the last few weeks, or, you know, this is what I'm drinking now nowadays, these, you know, these varieties, and, you know, these are my favorites, here's where you can get them. And so it's been great to have autonomy over, you know, anything that I write about, and that that they let me do it.
No, it's great. I it's like pretty much one of the only things that I like about the Georgia Strait. I mean, I'm not saying that in a negative way. I mean, like I there's a lot of great things that they promote in there for that are going on locality. Uh-huh. I just
Savage Love Story.
It is, yeah.
I just don't need to read it. I mean, yeah. I mean,
well,
the concert listings are great. The movies
are great.
Yeah, no, I love what it does. It's absolutely great for the city. I'm not shitting on it anyway. But I just, when I'm flipping through it, if I see because I like reading, because it's nice to read someone who actually knows what they're talking about. Right. I'm not saying that other journalists don't. It's just that, as you say, you are very hands-on. I'd say that's probably the best way to describe what your skill set is, especially in this industry, is you're very hands-on. You know, you work with importers and you work with restaurateurs, and you kind of have a little more of your hands are a little bit more knee-deep in things. So you're not on the periphery, which is, I'm a little bit similar, but I still work in the industry with what I do with Scout.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that Andrew was looking for when I came on with Scout Magazine. It's just like, he's like, I like the idea that you are still in the industry.
Right.
You're still working and you're still kind of in it, and you're still kind of, it's nice to, because I need some people in the back end to kind of do that stuff, because that's, you can be a little bit further away when you're not in it and you've been out of it for a little while. So
yeah.
Do you ever miss working in restaurants?
100%. Yeah. It's because I never left because I was bitter or I was tired of serving people or all. It was just kind of the right, you know, time for my career to evolve. When I miss it most is I find if I'm at a place at the beginning of service in the evening, and if I'm, you know, say having a drink at the bar or something like that, and I look and there's a pre-service meeting of the
pre-shift.
Staff.
Yeah.
Pre-shift.
And so, you know, doing the pre-shift, and then, you know, people are like rolling out, okay, we got this coming in tonight, there's this, and just that kind of before the show, that kind of energy of it, it's all starting. That's when I get the biggest pangs of it. I don't get them when I see someone, you know, locking up and tying up a patio at the end of the night. That I don't miss it. Or when I say to someone, hey, do you want to, they're like, oh, I got inventory. It's, oh, I don't miss inventory.
No. Yeah. Oh, Chill Winston, nice.
Nobody to loves inventory.
Locking up the Chill Winston patio was a pain in the ass. I think it was so big.
Massive.
Like, you'd be like,
there's like fucking like 700 tables out there.
I know that. And we had to lock it up every night. Oh, yeah. Man, it was such a pain in the ass. I was like, I hate this patio.
It's the end of the night. You're exhausted. You're tired. Yeah. You want to be done. And then
that
you're
thing
just...
printed money, though. Oh my God, that thing printed money.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I think I followed similar. I don't think I did this on purpose, but I think I've looked through your bio a little bit, but I think I almost followed a similar path of your wine training.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have your WSET diploma?
No.
You don't?
No, I did my initial.
I thought you did. I thought for some reason.
No, I did my initial WSET certification at the end of the 90s with Mark Davidson.
Mark Davidson, who is fantastic.
Yes, excellent.
One of the smartest men in the world when it comes to Australian wine.
Yeah. Yeah, he was amazing. His partner teaching, and they were the ones who actually brought WSET to Vancouver, was Park Heffelfinger, who's one of the owners of Memphis Blues, of that brand and a few of the locations. Barb Phillip, Master of Wine, who is the European wine buyer for the BC liquor stores, she was just starting to teach as well. So it was through them. So I had some great people there. And the way WSET was at the time, there was kind of your basic and your advanced, and then diploma. It wasn't kind of carved out the same.
It wasn't at the Art Institute yet, was it?
Yeah, it wasn't in thirds that. So I had done that. And then other things where just little smatterings I picked up along the way, the quartermaster sommeliers, I did the initial certification. I did distance learning with UC Davis.
I was going
to
do that.
For the intro to winemaking, which was just... because, you know, I just wanted to know when you're talking about certain tools in a winery or certain things. Okay, if you're adding tartaric acid, like, does that literally look like liquid acid, or is that a powder? Like, what is it? You know, I just wanted to know those things. So I did that. And then.
Did you do the full program?
No.
I signed up for it. I signed up for it twice. I was going to do it. And every time they're like, they put you on a waiting list.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, we'll call you in 6 months. And when you're in 6 months, you have to like start within like a couple weeks.
Right.
It's $2,000 per course. And there's like five of them. And then I was like, but you, when you're done, you get, it's like, it's kind of like, it's not a full anything, but it's kind of like a little certificate from the UC Davis, which is probably the biggest wine training school in all of the United States.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I want to do this. And then every time they do it, like literally when they do it, either... I was just like, I wasn't ready to do it at the time. And like, it's fucking hard.
Is that California?
Yeah. It's California. UC Davis is just, it's in just near outside Sacramento area.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you did the first one?
Just the intro to winemaking. And it was interesting because it was very, would be very American centric. And so there was just a lot of things about, you know, hybrids from Minnesota and, you know, regional things because... Mm. I believe all 50 states produce wine now, of varying quality. It was interesting.
And it's online, right? That. So you're doing the whole thing.
Well, at the time, it was like you could access it online, but at the time they would send you a stack of DVDs for the lectures. You put it. So what I liked is you could kind of pick and choose the timing of it. You know, you know what it's like if, say, you're doing WSET here or other courses, and if you've had a crazy day at work and whatever, and it's, well, your course is that night, no matter what, and so whether your mind's in it or not, you're going and you're doing it. Where this, you know, it was great because you could pick a time. Okay, I can totally focus now and do that. And
are you? And so you've done quartermaster. You've done
The initial certification. Yeah,
initial certification.
Have you thought about going? I have no diplomas. I have.
Have you thought about going further?
No, I have thought that I don't want to.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, I don't think you need to.
Yeah. Well, the thing, and yeah, when people, especially you know, way back, think, oh, you're gonna, you know, go towards Master of Wine, just no way. That doesn't do it. And you know, academia isn't really the goal or the focus of what I'm doing. You know, I feel that my job is to kind of elevate and encourage a wine culture in the city, and this is everything via my column. Via work I do with the British Columbia Wine Institute. I run, you know, trade education seminars for them. When I'm consulting with a restaurant, doing staff training, putting on events like Top Drop, you know, everything that I'm doing is to elevate and encourage.
You're like BC's version of Madeleine Puckett.
I try. I don't think I have the far reach or the success, but she's awesome. She's great.
And she's from, isn't it? Seattle.
She's from Seattle.
Yeah,
yeah. And she came when the when I hosted the Psalm 3 premiere at the Rio. She came and signed books, and we had a chat on stage. And
she has a blog, Mickey. If you don't, or anyone out there who doesn't know, she runs Wine Folly. So if you're looking for like any information out there, and you want to learn about wine, just go to her website and her blog. It's awesome. She does all these charts and really dummies it down and really makes learning about wine really simple. And she came out with a book just recently, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she did. Wow. And yeah, they have just great like infographics and just a page at a glance. And so, you know, like Rioja wines out of Spain, I don't really know. And then you go and it's a page and you just go, okay,
but I don't think
this is what I can expect. And
I don't think she has much training either.
She did the court. I don't know how far she went because she does have a background in sommelier in restaurants. And I believe it was the quartermaster sommeliers that she went through.
I just because I have my certified, and I know friends like Mark Shipway and Jayton James and Sean Nelson, who I've interviewed in the past, who've all passed their advanced. And they always ask me like, "Are you going to do it? You going to do it?" And I was like, "If I do the advanced, I'm models to do the master." And it's just like, I see and I've seen some and I've watched it, and I'm sure you obviously have a million times over, and you hosted it, but like I'm like, nope, I have no desire to do that.
It's just
I don't want to give up the next 5 years of my
life. I get stressed and anxious just seeing people go through it, never mind doing it myself. And I just don't have that, I don't know, the stamina and focus.
Well, I remember doing the diploma. I did the diploma, and I still have to write one exam to pass my diploma. I have the entire diploma done except one exam, and I failed it twice because it's so fucking hard. And Shipway has asked me to redo it, and it's, I've never been that stressed in my life. I was literally studying like 30 hours a week, and it's just, you got
to
know everything.
Yeah, it's tough when you have a job
and you have to work
and all that.
Yeah, it's just like, I just couldn't handle it. And I was just like, I have, in my mind, I've passed this. I was like, yeah, just because I don't have this. I might take the exam one day, but I'm just like, I needed a break after. I was like, going to have a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
So
maybe what you're saying is that real world experience, maybe have
School of Hard Knocks, right? Yes. That's what people put on there.
And what I was trying to get out here is I would say you know wine better than pretty much anyone I know.
Yeah.
So like you definitely know it better than I do. And I'm just saying like I was just curious about your past and kind of getting into it, but I mean, just, I know you know, like I'm not trying to disparage how much you know. I'm just like, it's nice to know that sometimes like, just like me, I don't have a journalism degree. And I have no intention of getting one, but you pretty much don't need one anymore. And I think with, like, I mean, look how far you've come with this.
Yeah, like I always wonder, was funny because when I'm writing contributed things, like, oh, I think I'm a nightmare for editors because I don't know. I put it in, usually it just seems like good enough and they tidy up things and make me look good. Yeah. But the thing is, you being a columnist, like I said, compared to being a reporter, like it's my voice that they want. Yeah. And so, it you know, they don't want me sounding, you know, neutral or anything like that. It's me and my approach.
Just perfect. Do you guys have any plans? Like, you already grown Top Drop now. You're in Calgary.
Yep.
So Calgary, it's the day before, or is it the day
after? 2 days before. So we're doing on the 21st. Okay. Yeah.
Are you planning on going Toronto?
Eventually, it's something, it's been mentioned. You know, we take a year back. Okay, this year, how did we do? Can we expand and all that? You know, we're taking this, and we don't want to rush anything because we want to do it proper and see it through. I think that we would love to do it in Toronto. Winnipeg has a great wine culture. Their wine festival is actually quite popular there. I think that we would.
My hometown, Saskatoon. I don't think we have wine culture there, unfortunately.
Winnipeg, not Saskatoon.
Yeah, I know. I wish.
But Saskatoon's growing like leaps and bounds, right? Like food wise, like there's a it's great food scene.
Cocktail
now.
Culture there is going pretty good. Mm-hmm. I don't know about wine culture. We think that we have it really bad here in BC with the BCL getting wines in this province. Yeah. Good luck getting into Saskatchewan. It's just like, well, it's a pain in the ass. Victoria, did you guys do Victoria?
We are doing one this year with a Vessel Liquor Store, which has, I think, the best wine selection in Victoria. They had put it out, they're doing kind of a top drop pop up. They put it out to us and said, hey, how many of your producers this year think any would be interested in doing, well, maybe, you know, an in-store tasting or something in. Okay, well, we'll see, you know, the day after Vancouver, if anyone wants to go over. So we put it to all 40 wineries, and 16 of them said yes. Perfect. They're like, oh, we better find a venue. And so it's going to be the International Marina there. And so if anyone out there in Victoria, just go onto the Vessel Liquor Store, onto their website, and there's all details on that. It's great. They're running logistics. They're doing it. So, yeah, it would have been a little bit too much for us to take on. So they're doing it. So yeah. So this year, technically, we have Calgary, Vancouver, and nice. Victoria.
So last few questions, then we're going to get you out of here because we know that you are a busy man right now because mm-hmm. the festival's next week.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on how BC is doing right now, wine-wise?
British Columbian wine?
Yeah. Like, how do you think we're doing nowadays?
You know, I
always ask this question to anyone who works in the industry.
That's actually one of the questions I was going to ask too. So thank you.
I think we're doing really good. I think that everyone has to be mindful that we've only, as you mentioned, it's only really since the very end of the 80s that we have started working seriously with vinifera, right? And so before that, it was Labrusca, it was hybrids. We didn't think that we could work with vinifera grapes. So, you know, we've only been working with the European noble varieties just under, you know, 3 decades now. So we're newest of the new world, right? We don't have millennia behind us. And you know, where our wines have, you know, how they've come along in such a short time, you know, when we first started having success, especially with reds, this is also in the heyday of, you know, the big California Cabs, the big Aussie Shirazes. And the first thing that we did is, you know, we ripened them as much as possible so we could show that we can, you know, be as heavy and juicy and as all of their wines. And then we would put tons and tons of oak on them and everything to try to emulate that. But, you know, no wine region becomes successful by trying to emulate another region. And the things that we have that come to us naturally, you know, because of our northern proximity with our shorter season, we do have a lot of natural acidity in our wines.
Which is what I love. One of the reasons the Loire Valley is my favorite wine region in the world, because of the main reason when I drink wine, I think acidity. That's what I always look for. Mm. I need acid. And that's why I love wines from the northern, from cool climate.
Yeah, and a lot of mineral-rich soils, particularly in the Okanagan, giving our wines more, you know, charisma and this purity of fruit, you know, because of, you know, the intense sun. And also just the fact that we have that big diurnal temperature shift, you know, it could be 30 degrees difference from day to night. So that helps preserve the acidity. And so those, you know, that acid, the minerality and everything that make our wine so fresh and bright and, you know, expressing place. In the old days, we suffocated all of that by ripening things too much and then putting all these planks of oak on it. So, you know, that's kind of been a big learning curve. And we're starting to, you know, sub-region-wise in the Okanagan really dial down. You know, we are focusing more on the Rieslings and aromatic whites and Pinot Noirs in the north, the richer reds, maybe the Rhone varieties, white and red down
Syrah's really starting to take off in the south too.
Yeah.
Which I really like. I think Syrah really does really well there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things that we always have struggled with, especially with Cab, is the growing season's just never been really long enough to have that. I mean, you get the heat.
Yeah.
You get the heat for sure, but it's just the length is just not long enough.
Yeah, but the Cab Franc, you know,
Cab Franc is amazing. Yeah.
Is great, and I like that we're starting to see you know, that lighter style, Allen at Synchromesh, Matt and Ross at Lock and Worth. We're seeing those Cab Francs that are more Loire like in weight and structure, not that they're trying to be or taste like wines from Loire, but you know, they're moving away from that Napa structure to that Loire structure. Well, and it shows up our fruit better.
And if you look at like the even everything on the West Coast, I mean, California's got definitely the two distinct main regions, you know, Sonoma and Napa. And then, I mean, they're starting to, a lot of the smaller EVAs are starting to really kind of emerge, especially with Alexander Valley and stuff like that, and Sonoma Coast, because I think Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir is some of the best Pinot Noir in the world. Mm-hmm. And then you've got what you got up in Oregon, where it's just really just two different styles, even though EOD Amity is really starting to really emerge. Mm-hmm. Good stuff up there, but it's just really straight Pinot Noir.
Walla Walla. That's a region, right?
That's in Washington.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's what I'm thinking of? Come back to me.
No, that's okay. But I mean, but the difference in styles between like Oregon is definitely smaller producers and really that kind of in-depth kind of stuff. And it's really just two main grape varietals, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. They're really trying to have that. Columbia Valley is up in Washington, but Washington's really just dominated by two major players, Chateau Saint Michel and Columbia Crest. But it's interesting how each region's kind of developed their own identity. And my thing that I've always felt with BC is that we're still trying to figure ours out. But I think as what you're saying right now is I think we're starting to come to that. Mm-hmm. We're starting to try to figure out what we do. And like, we're starting to get a lot more. We're starting to understand more of our microclimates and where we can grow wines in certain regions. And like the Similkameen Valley, I think is really starting to take off a lot. And we're actually starting to see a lot of stuff on the islands too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, Pinot Noir is that the quality that we're starting to see coming from Vancouver Island, which, you know, especially with the climate change, where it's going to become more and more of a challenge in California and elsewhere. I think that Vancouver Island really has a possibility to become an excellent, you know, globally renowned Pinot producing place because they're situated well.
Because one of the things with Pinot Noir is you need good diurnal range and you need something to cool down the berries at night because the skins are so thin, right? I mean, it's the classic line that Miles says in Sideways, right? It can only grow in certain pockets of the world. That's why I think Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir, I just love the flavor of it because you still get a lot of that bright fruit, but the acid is still there. Whereas if you just go a little bit more inland, you're going to lose a little bit of that. Like Carneros wines are a little bit different from Pinot Noirs. Mm-hmm. And then if you get Pinot Noirs from up in Willamette, it's got a lot more of that cranberry flavor just because of the soil type up there, because you have the Willackenzie and then you also have the, what's the limestone one? I can't remember. I'm trying to think of the other soil type up there. But they bring on a different flavor component. But like the Washington area. Vancouver Island area will give you something different.
One positive check mark for climate change for us here in BC, anyways.
Some wine regions are doing
it gets more
challenging elsewhere, but some regions do benefit and being able to grow, you know, at higher elevations and so on. So
look at the stuff coming out of Sea Star from Pender Island.
Oh my God, the beautiful stuff.
Their rosés are so delicious.
Are they?
And we sell them at the Fairmont.
Oh wow.
Yes, we get exclusive
Fairmont Pacific Wine.
Yes, you can thank Jill Spohr for that. We get an exclusive allocation.
Ah, Jill Spohr.
Yeah. So so that was one of the last questions I want to ask you. And there's a couple just quick hitting questions I want to ask you, and then we're going to be done. Has there ever been a wine region that you've never been to that you do want to go to?
Oh, basically all the ones that I've never been to. I've never been to the Loire. That's one that I'm pushing. I really need to get to. So the ones that I really want to get to Greece as well.
Nice.
I don't really know the wines from there, that we don't see a lot of them in our market. So I'd love to dive deep Loire Valley for sure. And I'm going to be in South Africa in the fall. I've never been, and everyone who goes and comes back, I'm like, oh my God, it's like,
well, they say it's most beautiful world, like vineyards in the world up in, like, especially if you go in Constantia and stuff like this, just outside Cape Town.
I had a guest in my bar that was telling me like the history of the vines there, because they were like during that whole transition between in the 1700s in France, where they had the hardcore Catholic people and then the other Protestant people, and there was like, they were like killing each other essentially. So all this migration happened from France on down to the south of Africa, and they brought a lot of the vines there and planted them back then, like that long ago. That's why the wines are so good there.
A lot
maybe full of shit. I don't know.
A lot of the places like that, New Zealand, Australia. You know, it is immigration that made it happen, and that's why in places like down in Australia, you have. And this is also pre-phylloxera, when they had to do, because of this phylloxera disease, this aphid, basically, overwhelmed and decimated vineyards throughout Europe. So everything had to be replanted, regrafted. But meanwhile, vines had already come and been planted in Australia. And so that's why in Australia alone, down in the Barossa, you have the oldest Shiraz or Syrah vines in the world, the oldest Mataro vines, the oldest Grenache vines from, you know, mid 1800s that they were planted. And so, and also some of the oldest soils, geologically speaking, in the world as well. So it is funny and a misnomer that we call Australia the New World when a lot more.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah. I think Australia is like one of the most emerging great wine producing countries in the world right now.
Exciting.
For so long, they were just always known as Wolf Blass and Yellowtail and stuff like this, which is
Eye roll.
Kind of their own fault. But I mean, they've had a real turn of a big turn of events over the last like 10 years with like a lot of the young producers and a lot of the great wines coming out of there, and like all the great wines coming from Clare Valley to Margaret River, even stuff from, I mean, Barossa is coming up with some great Shirazes now too. So I love what they're doing there. I think Chile is one of the only regions in the world right now that still flocks for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's one of the only ones. So that was the last one. And then favorite wine region you've ever been to?
Obviously a challenging question. However, I would say I'm going to kind of cheat a little bit. Margaret River in Australia. My wife is from Perth.
Oh, perfect.
And the reason I say that is because many people don't get there because it's in Western Australia, down in the very south, and it's, you know, one of the most isolated wine regions on the planet, and so people don't get there. And some fantastic, particularly Cabernets and Chardonnays that are grown there, but also it's literally some of the best surf in the world. Like international surfing competitions happen there, and it's full of these eucalyptus forests. And just driving down the highway, and you get the salty sea air and this eucalypt and just this kind of freshness. And it's so distinct that now I'm sure there's a little bit of power suggestion, but you those elements that you get in the wines, they have a really great community there, and a few excellent pubs that have phenomenal wine programs, but great local craft beer and everything. And it's just this tucked away pocket of the world that no one ever gets to, and more should, because there's some really cool things going on.
Why are we not drinking wine right now?
We should have.
This is so stupid.
Yeah. Fucked up.
I know, we fucked up. Why are we drinking beer?
So. Yeah, it's also 2:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah,
so.
It's very true. I have to work in a couple hours too.
Yeah, it's true. I'm off, so.
Do you have any other questions? You want to sponge off? Do you have any other things you want to sponge off?
I've learned a lot. If you could recommend one BC winery and one BC wine, what would it be? Just people listening to kind of get their feet wet a little bit.
Don't put it. Well, he does this. He reads his column.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe one that's not in the column.
I would say, okay, let me. I had mentioned them just a few minutes ago, and I recently reacquainted with Lock and Worth out of Naramata. Some of their fruit is sourced outside of Naramata, but they're just really fresh, honest, clean wines. They do a Semillon, 100% Semillon, that has some great Asian pear, little honey notes to it. Very fresh. They make a Merlot that tastes like Cru Beaujolais. It's just very lightly extracted, and it's just, you put a bit of a chill on it. It's super chuggable, delicious stuff. And like their wines are like $18, $19. So good. So
now you're speaking Mickey's language.
Yes. So that place, those wines.
Price point.
Yes.
You know, the wine
spring for like expensive wine. I bought a $70 beer once from the Ale Apothecary in Bend, Oregon.
Seven or 70?
70.
Wow.
One beer? 650 bomber. Yeah, Ale Apothecary, people listening, is in Bend, Oregon. They do terroir-specific aged ales, 2 years minimum. Man, like fantastic stuff. The guy, like, he built the cabin out of like wood from the trees in the forest nearby. Everything is like old world hipstery as you can get. The Ale Apothecary, can't recommend it enough. Very expensive beers, though.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Awesome.
Worth it? Meh.
He's a beer,
I don't know.
He's a beer nerd, by the way.
No, yeah, fair enough. I think the beer nerds are even nerdier than us wine guys.
Yes.
Which I like. So they've taken that whole, you know, snobby, beery kind of thing.
Well, I think the New Yorker famously had a magazine cover which featured, it was like a busy restaurant, and there's a couple sitting at the table, and the waiter has a 650 mil bomber. And this was like, I don't know, like 4 years ago or five years ago. And so the guy who's got a mustache and a little beanie cap like you wear is tasting the beer. So it was a very transitional point.
So, you know, there's one thing that I wish in Vancouver or the municipality in the city or whatever would try to encourage is we have a ton of beer tasting rooms in the city. I mean, obviously because the breweries are in the city, so it's a lot easier that way. But it'd be nice to have like in this whole area here, if you had just had a lot of some of the great wineries that are out in the Okanagan.
Yeah, satellite tasting rooms.
Where basically but they were pretty much the exact same style as like a brewery tasting room. Mm-hmm. People just go in there and they have little tasting plates of wines and the cheese and charcuterie. I just think that would go over really well. I think it would be a kind of a nice compliment to the city. And I think I saw a little bit in Portland when I was down there recently.
Yeah, for sure. And tourism-wise, it would be great and everything. So yeah, because that is one thing that, you know, people come here, they're here for a limited amount of time and they want to try the widest variety possible.
Yeah.
You know, and not everyone, you know, guys like us, you know, we're used to, if we go to a place in another city and we're curious, you know, we'll just ask, oh, can I try, you know, a splash of that? Can I try something? But, you know, people don't know that you can just go and get free wine or spirits or beer like that. Just ask to keep trying them until you get kicked out.
Stop giving away our secrets.
Well, my bar, minimum two. Okay. You can try two wines after that, and I'm too busy for you. I'm sorry.
Fair enough.
I also work at an airport bar, so.
All right.
Curtis, this was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We are very excited, and I'm going to bring you next week, by the way. You're going to come to the talk shop with me.
For people listening, this episode should be airing Saturday. So, and the event is
next Thursday. Next Thursday and Friday. Yeah. So the main event is on Friday. Yes. And Saturday.
Just on Friday.
Are you guys?
And it's sold out.
It's sold out. Oh, yeah. Okay,
so and so, but all the we still have tickets to the Thursday night events, like we were saying, these grazing ones at Campagnolo and the American, so, and Mammy Taylor's. We got Dougie from DL Download Chicken.
Download Chicken Shack.
Who wants to go to Mammy's though? I'm only there like twice a week.
You're DJing there. What's at the end of the month, you idiot.
I am DJing there. 26th.
Yes.
Should I just promote that right now?
Might as well.
Mammy Taylor's, they're having their annual Sunday Sessions event. You have to dress tiki. So Hawaiian shirts. I'm be playing from 3 to 9.
Cheap drinks.
Dope music. A lot of funk, a lot of soul, a lot of disco, a lot of indie stuff. It's going to be good. Cool. But, we love Ron.
Yeah. If you are interested, do check out the Chop Chop website. They're going to have a listing of all the events there that you can check out. Wildebeest, Campagnolo, Bodega, Mammy Taylor, stuff like that. And if you are interested in checking out Top Drop, if you are in the trade and you haven't registered, they might still have some space left over. I'm not sure if you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. As well, just think about it, the idea, if you love the Vancouver Wine Festival, next year, if you're really interested to going to this festival, I highly recommend it. This is fantastic. You're going to taste some great wines. You're going to have some great conversations with some people who are making some of the more unique terroir-driven wines in the world. And Curtis, I can't thank you enough for putting on this festival, you and Jeff Curry, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for making us sound good.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Anything else you want to plug?
Not right now. This is my sole focus.
Perfect.
Topdrop.ca. Yeah.
And he's moving too. He's moving, so I'm very excited.
Oh, just top it off with I'm moving.
Yes,
the most stressful event anyone can do in their life.
Exactly.
Is that, you're not moving June 1st, are you?
May 28th.
Oh, wow.
So yes.
Literally right
it's
after
go time. Yes. So.
But he's getting a patio, so it's right in perfect time for this.
Yeah,
perfect. So, gotta have that patio.
Yeah, I get to put my feet up.
So,
yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Curtis, thank you. And Mickey, we will, I guess everybody can find us as always on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. You can now find us on Luminary. Luminary is this new platform that's being launched as a kind of a premium service for anybody out there who's looking for premium content from certain podcasts. We are on there as well. Our new website, midrangevancouver.com, is going to be launching on June 1st. We have our Instagram page, which is already listed, so you can check us out right there, MidrangeYVR. We are going to be combining the Track and Food podcast and the Beats on Repeat podcast, Mickey's new podcast, Flux, where he does all this weird music.
And weird ass shit.
We're
going to
be
cool.
launching a new podcast as well. It's going to be called Midrange, and it's just going to be a pop culture podcast featuring Tristan Young and myself, where we debate things that are going on in the pop culture sphere every week. Mm-hmm. And we're going to make Mickey edit that every week, so he's looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. And our website's going to be awesome. We're going to be doing a lot of stuff on food, music, film. Check us out.
Photography, art.
Art. We're going to be having a launch party at Mammy Taylor's in June sometime, so look for that.
And we're Mammy Taylor's again. Jeez.
We just love these guys.
You should
we don't like to walk
us.
Further than a block. That's what...
Sponsor us, Ron Oliver, for fuck's sakes. You're rolling in money, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. But in the meantime, Curtis, thank you so much, and we'll check you another day.
Thanks for having me.